Whence came their kin? Meanwhile in Gaza, they're not letting the food in. They're clearing out their cabinets across the USA from all the workers fired before they might get in the way of the consolidation of power. Even more inept and kleptocratic than ever before. And the word came from the White House, let the genocide begin. Meanwhile in Gaza, they're not letting the food in. Media's focus, or at least the lion's share, when it's not honed in on the orange man's hair, is just asking the question, what is to be done if in the Ukrainian war the Russians have won and Europe falls under the evil Putin? Meanwhile in Gaza, they're not letting the food in. About freedom from a dictator's control of the great sacred mission to make Ukraine whole. Democracy matters somewhere, anyway, like Europe and the USA. But as for Ramallah, it's let the colonists win. Meanwhile in Gaza, they're not letting the food in. Plan is to starve them until they come out. In order to annex first, they have to have a route. Make them die, and whoever's still there can find some country to take them or go somewhere. The hedge fund managers say chin chin. Meanwhile in Gaza, they're not letting the food in. They're clearing out whole neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. While Europeans aren't the only ones bemoaning political and economic stagnation, in North America, too, citizens are generally agreed they are suffering, if not a crisis, then certainly a malaise of democracy. Compounding that is the apparent abandonment of foundational mores of Western civilization, witnessed through the aiding and abetting of Israel's genocide in Gaza, and reinforced by American President Donald Trump's expressed desire to abrogate international law and annex Canada, Greenland, Panama, and further parts south too. Ian Tadon is an independent scholar and author, publishing at Haislick.substack.com, probing, he says, the tensions between past and future, memory and progress, through the fault lines of philosophy, storytelling, and cultural critique. It's where I found his February article, The Technate of North America, How the New Oligarchy Plans to Rule the Future. Welcome to the program, Ian.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Ian, how does the technate you describe differ, if it does do, from the ideals of the so-called technocratic state proposed almost a century ago?
Yeah, well, technocracy was a 1930s ideology that believed that engineers should run society instead of politicians. The dream was, if we apply science to everything, the economy, governance, even daily life, we'll build rational, efficient, post-political utopia. So everything would be optimized. There's no waste, no poverty, no confusion. You'd get energy credits instead of money based on whatever is most efficient for society. It's not just a quirky sci-fi. It was also soaked in elitism and racial ideology. You find, for example, in the Canadian wing of it, of technocracy as a movement, leaders like Joshua Haldeman, who is incidentally Elon Musk's grandfather, who tied technocracy to Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism. He fled to South Africa eventually, which he called a paradise for white people. Now, how does that differ from what we have today? Fast forward a century, and the same logic is back with better PR. Replace the engineers in their lab coats with coders in hoodies, algorithms in the cloud, and it's just a dream, but updated. It's no longer just a tech utopia or fully automated luxury communism, in a way. It's a high-stakes mission to save America or save the West from total collapse. ecological, political, civilizational, with tools like artificial general intelligence, robots, crypto, and colonizing space. So in a way, it's the same offer as before. Democracy is too slow, too messy, so let the smart ones take the wheel. But this time, it's not just sold as progress, it's sold as our salvation.
Do you think that they genuinely believe this ideology, or is this just a smoke and mirrors, something to gull the masses into allowing themselves to be drawn into this system that largely views them as certainly not equal beings, maybe not even human beings at all?
I think the answer is a bit contrasted here. I think they absolutely believe the myth of engineers and scientists, and generally speaking, the smartest people being in charge as a desirable thing and something that is necessary. And conveniently, they believe that they are these people. The things that I don't think they really believe in a utopian future. I think every time they talk about the masses, it's not in good terms. I think we're not going to Mars anytime soon. And I think any realistic scientist would know that. You know, it's decades or centuries of terraforming. It's years of travel if we get it right. And there are lots of places that are more inhospitable than Mars. You know, Antarctica has nicer temperatures, already has oxygen and water. So I think a lot of these things are just really excuses for two things. One is, let us be in charge. Let us be in control. We're going to fix the system that was broken. We're going to make this economy more efficient. We're going to bring electric vehicles. We're going to bring artificial intelligence, robots, etc. And yeah, once you let us be in charge, we're going to not just fix the economy, but make everything better for everyone in a way. We're going to go ahead with our project. I think in many ways they're communicating that, saying that democracy and freedom are not compatible, or that, you know, politics is broken and that instead we need to trust their systems. I think, you know, I don't know if I subscribe to a theory that that's going to lead to the population being drastically reduced. But I think in a way, making a lot of the population irrelevant, depending how you look at it, a lot of the agency of the population is already, it's already gone, arguably.
In the article, you talk about the fact, in, I was talking about democracy with my first guest, Diana Johnstone, in France and in Europe being eroded. You talk about their democracy being replaced by a subscription model, that we're not citizens so much as subscribers. We don't have rights. We have privileges, and those privileges are subject to removal or erasure, even as we can see in the United States right now, where people with the wrong papers are having their privileges of attending removed, and them removed with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sense, you know, I think it's a little bit of a scary message that I'm going to have here, but it's already happening, and arguably we're already past the point of them taking over and somewhere or even deep into the consolidation phase. There's still a government, but it doesn't really rule. There's still a state, but it's not really operating. It's being dismantled, and the parts of it that still function basically serve the interests of the few, or democracy still perform, but no longer really determines power. And more than this, I would say they're going after everything that could stand in the way. The federal workforce being dismantled, agencies altogether being destroyed, overwhelming the courts with, you know, executive orders that may or may not go beyond the reach of presidential powers, and different decisions that can be overturned, but the plane is already in the air, et cetera, et cetera. They're even going as far as targeting the law firms that represent their critics or opponents. So it's quite overwhelming. It feels chaotic because it is chaotic. That's part of the method in a way. The playbook that they've used in business before, you know, you move fast and break things. You blitzscale faster than any regulator or competitor can react. using loopholes, hollowing out the institutions, and then consolidating power as much as you can. In a way, you know, there's a lot of problems that are created also by the companies that they've built that are now mixing with what we're seeing, right? The election interference, the social media breakdown, and the influence it has on the way we consume media and information bubbles. There's all the issues that are created for governments with all these new things to regulate and all these new modes of competition, etc. And then they just declare that the governments are basically obsolete. Once everything's collapsing around, they are basically the only solution left. Who else is going to build, you know, artificial intelligence and electric vehicles to save us and rockets to go to Mars or even just say free speech, which is what Elon Musk said he was doing when he was purchasing X.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ian Tadun. Ian is an independent scholar and author publishing at hayslick.substack.com, probing what he says is, quote, the tensions between past and future, memory and progress through the fault lines of philosophy, storytelling, and cultural critique. And it lives up to all of that, believe me. We're talking around his article, The Technate of North America, How the New Oligarchy Plans to Rule the Future. Yes, Ian, you describe the chaos as being success, if I can paraphrase. The steps to for the masters of the technate is, you know, smash and grab, smash the systems that exist, grab the reins of power and run these systems. And do it faster than anybody can keep up. You can look at what's going on in the United States right now to get a fairly clear example of that, I would argue. What I wonder, Ian, is are they equipped for the task? I wonder, like, with this tariff imbroglio that we were seeing with Trump's tariffs, discovering that they're algorithmically determined, the Prime Minister of Israel recently in Washington, D.C., because Israel got a 17% tariff based on the algorithm, not on any political consideration, but just because that's what the machine said. I wonder if, do you think that they anticipated that? And if they didn't, are they really prepared to run a post-smashed society?
I mean, I want to ask you back, what do you think? But my take is absolutely not. I think these are people who think in terms of system, who are used to working in the realms of physics or computer science. And the world is not a system, right? We don't live in systems. We live in ecosystems. You cannot move fast and break things. Arguably, you shouldn't do that in business, but beyond business, when you're talking about human societies and human lives, there are consequences that last, that linger. And the things that you break are not as easy to rebuild as writing another patch or another line of code. If we think, for example, of what's happening today with the tariffs, right, and this general stock market craziness, the reaction of all the other countries, of course, who feel like that's not exactly what you expect from an ally, but it's also questioning global trade and global institutions as we know them. There's also, more generally speaking, going across borders, going around and bullying other countries, Greenland, Canada to Colombia in the south, and we can maybe get deeper into that in a second, why these countries in particular. But I would say, no, they're not equipped at all, I think, to prevent any form of collapse. I don't think that's necessarily their plan. I think they're going for the collapse and trying to be what stands after it. And I think what stands after it is incredibly dystopian for everyone else. I don't think there is... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just don't think, I when you ask me, what do I think? I don't think they've got the legs to stand up after the collapse. I don't think that they're prepared, as with this tariff, you know, when it's, you know, putting tariffs on islands that have nothing but penguins on them and such like this. I don't think that they're equipped to be the ones standing after everything else falls apart. I can't imagine a technocrat like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk standing in the middle of Damascus during the chaos and taking command of the situation, you know?
No, I think it's more about an escape plan that they have, and they don't have one for the rest of us. Really, it's about, these networked cities that they are building, about these even literal bunkers that they are building, about basically having doomsday plans, and also even just this idea of immortality, of trying to cheat death and to remain here forever. The consequences of that for everyone else, of course, are dystopian if we can get the science right to get there. But in both things, they're investing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in, this, in a way, a group of very wealthy individuals that some have called the super class, trying to make sure that whatever happens with the environment, the economy, and society doesn't cannot affect them, that they're away from harm. And so, in a way, there is that, and there is also this very simple idea of orchestrating the collapse of everyone else while you build solutions for the rest. You can declare that the federal government is completely inefficient, and at the same time, you get literal billions in subsidies for SpaceX, and you get a lot of knowledge transferred from NASA, who is all too happy to see private sector competitors to the incumbents. And so, in a way, SpaceX becomes NASA because they can't really launch anymore on their own. They're gonna need partners to do it. They get the power, in a way, to take us to Mars. The American taxpayer paid for the research, pays for the subsidies and the launches, but instead of being a public institution, it's now in private pockets. It's in that sense that I mean, standing after the collapse. It's not so much having the institutions that we know today, having the rule of law and maintaining a semblance of order and life in a world that is collapsing. It's really very selfishly and personally putting themselves away from harm, and I think they have many, many plans and many, many resources to do that.
Well, who's going to clean the toilets and the bunkers is what I'd like to know. You've got a you call them the super class. Well, in another article you have up, and again, it's at heyslick.substack.com, the New Olympians. Do you want to describe a little bit, Ian, about this article, The New Olympians, Tech Billionaires and the Myth of Progress?
Absolutely. Yeah, the idea was really to try and look at the myth that inspired the billionaires, or the narratives that they try to build around themselves. And as you find very often, right, you always find a mythic resonance in the narratives that we have and that people tell. And so there are a few things that are relevant here. There's gods above us, in a way, Olympians ruling from above. There's Prometheus, bringing us the gift of fire and innovation. And then we can also look at myths that are a little bit less positive or contrasted in a way that I think are just equally relevant. But there is the Tower of Babel, where we're trying to build beyond the earth. And it's quite literal now with this idea of like space elevators and going to mine asteroids and sending missions to Mars. And building new languages to do that quite literally with software, and not necessarily thinking about what happens when you try and build too high, what happens when you defy the gods in the story. There's also Icarus, I think, is relevant here. If we think about flying too close to the sun, and in a way, this idea of through technology we're going to be able to do new things, and we're taking all of mankind, or we're taking America with us. And well, maybe the wings are just gonna melt mid-flight. And I think that is my answer to what you were asking me earlier. Do I think they are capable of actually accomplishing much?
Yes, well, we all know what happened with the Tower of Babel and Nimrod's arrow and Icarus, whose shadow flew too near the sea rather than his wings too near the sun. In you have another article, and this is, I've got to admit, I've never heard of Neal Stephenson before, but Neal Stephenson mapped the fractured future. Now we're living in it. And you're going over some of his titles and And you say that Snow Crash, The Rise of the Franchise States, it's a 1992 book of his. You say that, well, we're living in this right now, and you refer to that book as less science fiction than a blueprint for what we're living. I hope that Neil didn't mean it that way, but it seems to be taken up that way, at least you argue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting about science fiction, right? Is the stories that we tell usually prescient of something about the future, or they amplify something that we can glimpse at or already experience somehow today. And some authors are really, I would say, prescient in the way they understand things. And I think Neal Stephenson in particular is really probably the best guide in a way to understanding what's unfolding. He's also a very entertaining and very well-researched writer, so you will probably enjoy them and learn a thing or two in the process. But in Snow Crash, for example, he describes a world where the United States is no more. It's more a network of corporate-run city-states and enclaves that belong to franchises and different privatized institutions. Well, the thing is, now you actually find people who have put some thought or at least intellectual varnish around these ideas and made them palatable enough that people with deep pockets and big ideas like Peter Thiel end up actually funding projects. You can think, for example, of Curtis Yarvin, who is a neo-reactionary thinker and a very big influence on the current administration and some of the people who fund it, who openly advocates to basically end democracy and put a ruler CEO or corporate monarchy in place. And in many ways, I think that's something that we're seeing unfold, right? You have an unelected official-ish person, Elon Musk, in charge of a department that's been created ad hoc to basically go pursue efficiency with absolutely no mandate from any voter, but still with the power to gather information on every federal employee and every citizen, and to fire employees and to close entire agency, to end contracts. So in a way, you can already see this privatization of everything happening and being actually pushed forward. Yeah, and there are also these, you know, enclaves being built. There's Prospera. There are some ideas of building some cities in Greenland where, you know, you can go outside of the normal jurisdictions and get DNA injections to rejuvenate your cells. And you can get different medical procedures that you can't get elsewhere. And that's a project funded by Peter Thiel and other Silicon Valley entrepreneurs.
Is that like adrenochrome?
Sorry?
The adrenochrome, you know, the thing that taking this hormone out of young children and injecting it into the rich.
it's actually, you know, more like biohacking and procedures that today are not necessarily sanctioned or available in other places. But so it's a city in Honduras where basically they negotiate an agreement with the government to have less legal constraints and regulations than elsewhere in the country. And so it's kind of this place where rich people can go. And I don't remember the exact procedures. I don't think it has much to do with young children, but it's just there were some basically DNA procedures and... Anyway, you can look it up. Basically, it's pretty interesting. It's called Prospera in Honduras, and it's Prospera. One example of, you know, just to come back to Neal Stephenson in a way of these private enclaves rising. Right? What are your rights if you visit Prospera? Because it's in Honduras, but do you really depend on the jurisdiction of Honduras, or do you really depend on the jurisdiction of this private enclave? And in a way, it's one, you know, interesting thing that you could see with Doji, where you have private guards now guarding some federal institutions. They're from this company called Triple Canopy. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing because it puts into question the whole accountability, right? Whose orders do they depend on? Have they sworn the same oath to protect the Constitution and to not follow orders that go against the Constitution or that are illegitimate. No, they're private contractors. They're getting paid at the end of the month for their loyalty.
Well, and we can see another aspect of this unfolding in another country, a neighbor of Honduras, in El Salvador, with Bukele, the man who touts himself as the hippest dictator in the world, and this horror prison system that he's built. And when they make mistakes, they go, oopsie, and with a happy, laughy face emoji, much like the president of the United States did just the other day after blowing up a bunch of innocent civilians. And it was like, oopsie, but it was their fault for being Yemenis. We're fast out of time, Ian. Can you tell our listeners how they can find your work and support it?
Yeah, absolutely. So you named it a few times, but the best way to find my work is HeySlick, that's H-E-Y dot S-L-I-C-K dot Substack dot com. They can also find me on Blue Sky at intdon, or HeySlick at bluesky.com or intdon at bluesky.com.
Well, it's a fascinating article, and we can't do it justice in this format. So I really urge listeners to go to Ian's site. It's the Technate of North America: How the New Oligarchy Plans to Rule the Future, and the future is going to be what's the line? It is bought, not the future's not unfolding. It's bought or something. Sorry, and I've forgotten the.
Yeah, it isn't being written, it's being bought.
It's not being written, it's being bought. And you're not a part of the sales slip, I'm afraid, sweetheart. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking a little bit about this today, Ian.
Thank you. And maybe a last word is just, I think there's always hope. And I think, you know, we don't have to accept that as the future. I think we can build better futures.
Indeed. And they rely on us. They rely on our despair to bring this nightmare to fruition. Thanks to Diana for coming on. That's all I've got for this time. Until the next time. Thanks again, Ian.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mahmoud Khalil was born a refugee. Last December, he got a master's degree. He was a student at Columbia when the war began. To be expelled and deported had not been the plan. But sometimes you have to step up, and that's what he did. His training started early as a little kid. Growing up in Syria, in a slice of Palestine, exiled by 1949. Mahmoud Khalil spoke oftentimes before the press who came to cover this protest against the war. The tents which got exactly the attention that they sought, to speak out against the destruction our country's policies have wrought. As the bombs kept falling on the children down below, some people had to do something, and the place where they could go was the protest camp. And that's where people went, and that's where you could find him, with the backdrop of tents. Mahmoud Khalil was at home with his pregnant wife when one day came the visit that would change his life. Trump said he'd deport them, and now he's following through. ICE agents came and got him, as they were sent to do, with no uniforms or warrants, just an order for a raid. A week into Israel's complete blockade, they say he supports the resistance, though nothing can be found aside from horror at the buildings in Gaza collapsing to the ground. Mahmoud Khalil is in detention, they're not saying where. For evidence against him, they've not a tweet to share. ICE agents on the campus, what's next nobody knows, with an administration happy whichever way it goes. And silence from the Congress, except for one or two. The leadership apparently thinks it's a fine thing to do to suspend the rule of law in defense of genocide. The future possibilities are open wide.